Show us your shit now. Oh, okay.
Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust way back in 2002, and goes out every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week, Sarah Bromberg looks at how cuts have been biting in Bristol. Also, Eddie James takes a look at the Palestinian and Israeli peace protest. He's from Bristol's Palestine Museum. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol. We're just off Queen's Square. You can call them on 0117 989 7733 or visit them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. But we start this week with Sarah Bromberg, who's been looking at how the cuts have been biting here in Bristol. Prior to 2006, there used to be a wealth of services in the city for people to fill time with during the holidays. But since the housing crash of 2007 and the recession of 2008, cuts in funding have seen services decline or disappear altogether. So what's the government doing to restore services to the Bristol area? Sarah?
A quote from the Daily Telegraph states that we entered the recession in the second quarter of 2008 before the economy plunged to its low point in the first quarter of this year, 2009-2010. 2.5% contraction in the disposable income.
So that's 2.5% contraction in disposable income. That's actually the amount of money we've got in our pocket. Youth services and art spaces have all but disappeared, or have they? And what's been put in their place for people desperately in need of help? Here are some art services that you can still get involved with today in 2014, from much of which has gone, but there is still some left, Sarah, isn't there?
Yep. There's the Bristol Mile, Festival of Nature, the Balloon Fiesta, the Big Green Walk, Kite Festival, Bristol Walking Festival, the Bristol's Biggest Bike Ride, the Half Marathon, the BrizFest, and Bristol Food Connections.
Okay, so there's still some stuff going on. What's the most popular form of media being used to reach young people to keep them off the streets?
According to youthnet.org, the internet is the most popular form of media being used to reach young people today. 45% said they are happiest online, 75% said they couldn't live without the internet, 86% said they loved how new technology helped them communicate with other people, 96% said they used other media's devices whilst using the internet.
Okay, what about after-school activities to keep these projects open, you know, and also to get new talent?
There is the Bristol Dinosaur Project. According to the website, they have said that they'll build a massive dinosaur at M Shed on a live, open-to-the-public event. Also, according to the website, this will be the combination of 4 years of our very successful Bristol Dinosaur Project, and we would like to invite everyone to come and visit us. The event will start on the 1st of October and will run on Tuesday till Sunday until the end of November.
Well, that sounds like the sort of thing that maybe should be going on during the summer holidays for youngsters. Dinosaurs, yeah. You know, giant lizards, I suppose, you know, is there really any, you know, entertainment value? I suppose there is for some people. But anyway, what about the lottery? What lottery-funded projects are being run over Bristol during the summer?
The Lightbox Happiness Project was also, according to its website, is a not-for-profit community interest company. And its current project, the Happiness Project, is run by 4 staff members and a large team of volunteers. Lightbox has worked with a variety of support services in Bristol, such as Tech and Step Housing Association, Bristol Drugs Project, and Shandos House, and has received the support of NHS Bristol, Bristol City Council, and the Arts Council, as well as several other big name projects, and most recently the Big Lottery Fund.
Okay, so if you're stuck at home, bored all day, fed up with rejection letters, I mean, this is job applications that you're supposed to send out. I mean, you know, a lot of people who are unemployed are sending out. I mean, I know several people who are sending out maybe 7, 8, 9 CVs, job applications a week, and still getting absolutely nowhere. Obviously, the jobs ain't there, you know. So if you're stuck at home, bored all day, you can check out thesite.org. What is thesite.org?
The site are a place to have tons of ideas, such as volunteering, dog walking, babysitting, or even asking a local business if you can create a Twitter or Facebook account for them. But remember to ask permission first. They even suggest asking your neighbours if they need tutorials on online shopping.
So the idea is that you create at home a Facebook account for some business. But I mean, you know, surely they should be paying someone to do that, shouldn't they?
The idea is that it's free initially, and then you start paying, and then I guess you start paying off, start paying later.
Well, that's not much good, is it? I mean, it's like working for Poundland when for free. There seems to be quite a lot of exploitation going on of people, Sarah. Anyway, why are the services for the most vulnerable? Why are those the ones that are being cut, Sarah? Finally,
I guess it's because the Bristol Council just is lacking the money and the means to. Get the services to the people that need it most.
But there are all sorts of things like corporate welfare around. I mean, big companies that are getting tax breaks, they are not vulnerable. Surely most people want their tax money to be being spent on vulnerable people rather than people that have already got plenty of money.
Yes, I agree. I think the services are being spent in the wrong place, and I think maybe the council needs to have a bit more of a look at where they are spending money and where they're not.
Sarah, what are your thoughts about what can be done about this if people are actually trying to lobby the City Council to try and get them to focus more on spending money on the vulnerable? How can they do that?
Maybe we need to have a new census or a survey at the end of the year to see how people feel. Have some more questionnaires put out in the next general elections to see where the vote's going. And
well, also, of course, you can use your vote, can't you? When it comes to it, you can use your vote in May. In fact, this month, or next month, if you're listening to this, isn't it? Yeah, it changes this week from April to May. But that's one thing you can do is to vote for somebody you think is actually going to look after the more vulnerable in our society. Anyway, Sarah Brumbrook, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And I'm joined now by Eddie James from the Palestine Museum, the Palestine Embassy. How can you have a Palestine Museum and a Palestine Embassy here in Bristol, Eddie? Are you really actually able to give out things like help people get their visas for Palestine?
No. I wish we could, but as yet, it's not quite happened. I mean, Palestine isn't a country, so how can it have an embassy?
Isn't it? I thought it had representation at the UN.
It has, but that's observer representation. So basically, the idea is we wanted to give them terra firma. We wanted to give them an actual embassy. And that's what we've done.
Okay, fantastic. You're based on Broad Street. Just give us your sort of review of why this is an important struggle that's going on in the Middle East for you, on the serious side.
Well, I personally believe that the problems of the world do emanate from the injustice of the Middle East, in particularly the clearing of the Palestinian lands for a Jewish state. I think in basically what is an Arab country to kind of expel the very people that have lived there since time immemorial and replace them with what is basically a Western, you know, mindset was going to cause problems.
But aren't the Jewish people originally from that part of the world?
Well, I wouldn't think so. I mean, certainly not the Russian Jews. I would have thought that majority of the people of the Palestinian race stayed actually in the Middle East, and they would be Iranian, you know, Iraqi Jews, etc. They would be like the Palestinians, part of that same heritage.
So you're saying that really the settlers, the Israelis, are a sort of, you know, they've been brought in as migrants, immigrants, really, into that part of the world.
I would think so. I mean,
certainly they look European, don't they? Most Israelis, they seem to be, you know, their complexion, skin complexion, or whatever.
Well, you've only got to look at the buildings. Tel Aviv is a modern. It could be Croydon, Benidorm. You know, but basically the mindset, the militarism, the kind of the whole emphasis on consumerism is very much a Western mindset, not an Arabic one.
Okay, so, now as a museum, what sort of things can people see in the city centre here in Bristol?
Well, what you'd get from the museum would be the history of the people from the Cainite, which is 5,000 years, through to the present day. So you get a snapshot of everything that's fallen before them. Obviously, it's a wonderful country, it's still a wonderful country. I mean, there's still miles of country there that needs to be looked after. It needs to be divided properly. But it's a wonderful part of the world, and it's basically it's more than a heritage site for old religions. So it's basically a very important area. It needs TLC, which it hasn't got. So the museum tries to give a kind of more than a snapshot, but in limited time, in limited space, we show the Palestinian of old, its beauty and its industry, and then the tragedy of the Nakba, when 90% of the people were, you know, forcibly removed or frightened into moving. Either way, they left, and then obviously the 400 or 500 villages that were, you know, taken over were now repopulated, or some of them destroyed. So a new people from Europe came into the area that was once Palestine.
The interesting thing about all this, of course, is it's largely Britain's fault or Britain's responsibility, the way that things went after the Second World War, because it was a British protectorate. British troops were in Palestine up until the creation of the Israeli state. 1947, I think it was, and the US was the first country in the world to recognise the new state of Israel, which had been really formed by the Irgun and terrorist gangs, Jewish terrorist gangs. But I mean, what part do you think Britain has played? Because, I mean, it wasn't a colony as such, it was a protectorate. In other words, the League of Nations between the wars had said to Britain, we would like you to look after this part of the world. It needs a bit of law and order. There's lots of things going wrong there. And the British just sort of brought their police and their troops in just to try and keep law and order. And then they were removed. So to what extent was it really a British responsibility? Because I suppose the other side of this, it's a horribly long question, I'm sorry, Eddie, but is that the Zionist movement also originated in Britain, and that was one of the things that largely led to the creation of the State of Israel after World War II.
Yeah, that's true. I think the problem actually was before. I think the Balfour Agreement was probably the initiating factor. But I think as far as Britain's concerned, they would hold a lot of responsibility. But the Zionists did negotiate, I think, with the the Ottomans did negotiate with the Zionists, I think, at one stage. I'm not clear on that history. But the fact is that Lawrence of Arabia, the Palestinians were drawn into a sort of game of, well, if you support us, we'll give you your state. The problem is that there was duplicity there, because Britain was also promising the Zionists their state. So they were lying through the teeth. And then America, of course, they were always jealous of Britain's control over the oil fields. So they wanted a presence, in the Middle East, and back in the Jewish, Zionist kind of confederation was a way of doing it. So basically, I would think that Britain ended up being pawns in what was an American Zionist game.
But hang on a minute, because the actual state of Israel itself is not an oil-rich state. I mean, they've got a lot of water, but it's the Arabs that have always had the oil, not the Israelis.
What capitalism wanted was a presence, a military presence in the Middle East. And, obviously that's what the Jewish people promised. I mean, they promised them that they would give them support, and they would give them not just military support, but also moral support if they backed them. And I think Iraq, if you think of the war in Iraq, that was perhaps one of the first indications of the military combination of AIPAC, Jewish,
This is the American Israeli Public Affairs Committee,
it's very strong.
A very powerful motivator in US politics for both of the main parties, Democrat and Republican. Most of their senators and congressmen are financed basically by AIPAC money. And when we've just heard this week, for example, John Kerry saying that Israel's in danger of slipping towards becoming an apartheid state, well, all of a sudden there's a massive hoo-ha about that, and he's got to retract that comment. It just shows how powerful the Israeli lobby is in the US particularly. I mean, we've actually got Labour friends of Israel and Conservative friends of Israel here in Britain too that have a large amount of clout, a lot of sway. But look, getting back to the brass tacks on this, we often hear about whether it's possible to have one state which includes Palestinians and Jews. And that's the one state solution or the two state solution. What are your thoughts about which is going to work?
Well, I mean, I understand.
That's all we really want, is something that works.
Yeah. Well, it's not for me to say, but we're there to assist the Palestinians on two counts, one for their future and one for the miserable presence that they're in. And I would say the fact that Hamas and Fatah are now joined together at least gives the opportunity for the Palestinians to speak as one voice.
Now, these are two large factions in Palestinian politics, aren't they?
They are, yes.
And so for years they've been actually taking a different approach, one which is a more militant approach, the other a bit less. But just literally last week, these two factions have come together. Mm. They've signed an agreement, and the Israelis, as a result, have completely pulled out of all the peace talks.
Well, they always wanted an excuse, and that's it, isn't it?
What they're saying, Eddie, is that they refuse to negotiate with terrorists, and Hamas, they consider Hamas a terrorist organisation.
That's right. It's easy to typecast, Hamas as a terrorist, but remember, Gaza is a sealed state. It's like a penitentiary. It's not a normal state. That particular group inside Gaza only represents Gaza. They don't represent the West Bank. It's a separate entity. And so this is the first time in politically, I think, that Gaza and the West Bank have been joined together. So this is the start of the first true voice of the Palestinian people. What they decide on when they're joined together and they allow some form of separate autonomy would be, for them, and I think I'm hoping that they would go for the common sense thing, which is one country, two people living, coexisting under one flag.
But the same as somewhere? Because the trouble has always been in countries where there's a very big split between one side and the other, like Northern Ireland, for example, is very difficult to guarantee those minority rights if you've got one state. I mean, so what do most Palestinian people want?
Well, this is something that we're hoping we'll find out. At the moment, we have a group of different people from BDS to PSC, Palestinian Solidarity Group. You have these different kind of representatives trying to help the Palestinians, and they have their opinions, but by and large, it's what the Palestinians want. As yet, we have not established that. We've just had these voices speaking on behalf of. So we're not quite sure as to what the Palestinian people want on the ground.
Yeah, the other thing, of course, is this is the Holy Land. It's a place that a lot of people like to visit. It's got an amazing biblical tradition, the New Testament, and other things. But a lot of people there are Christians. We don't often hear about that in places like Bethlehem and towns like that. What's life like in these places in the Holy Land now that most people would have heard of, say, through Bible stories? Bethlehem, what's life like now
It's a good question. I mean, we've got photographs of Bethlehem, and we've got different groups that have actually, been to Bethlehem, and they give their opinion, but that would just be their opinion. So personally,
are we talking about checkpoints?
Well, there'd be checkpoints. Sort of, I mean, obviously, if you're Jewish Israeli, then there's very few boundaries. If you're a Palestinian Christian, there's a few more boundaries. If you're Muslim Palestinian, there's a lot of boundaries. So it's a question of, what shade of, Middle Eastern character you are as to whether you have freedom of the country.
Okay, just remind us whereabouts you are in the city centre again.
Okay, if everybody knows the centre, if they know Corn Street, Nicholas Market, then we're just more or less a stone's throw from.
So you go up Corn Street, don't you, just with St Nicholas Market on your right hand side, and then at the top you turn left down Broad Street.
That's correct, and you'll note it by that wonderful arch, probably one of the oldest buildings in
town. It's part of the city wall, isn't it?
It's 12th century.
Yeah. It's part of the city wall, the original city wall.
It's part of the city wall, yeah.
And so before you get to that, you'll find the Art Bar and the Palestine Embassy Museum on the left-hand side. Have you got a Palestinian flag flying on the top?
We have, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Eddie, lovely to talk to you, but I'd just like you to finish by telling us what is on at the Art Bar, because I know you've had your licence taken away, which is a bit of a disaster, isn't it, for any kind of venue in the city centre. Suddenly people take your licence away. Why was that?
Well, I think obviously we're very political. We represent many groups, from anti-fracking to, anti-nuclear you know, anti-NATO.
Licensing committee can't take your license away because you're political. What have they actually said that you haven't done or what you're supposed to have done?
Yeah, Inspector Rundle, which actually it was his review of our license that took place. Actually, in his documentation, he says these people are known activists. And they associate with squatters. So obviously there was a political element, otherwise he wouldn't have said that.
But isn't it more to do with simply things like you don't have the right signs in the right places, emergency exit signs, signs for where the toilets are, maybe facilities, fire alarm facilities, that sort of thing?
Well, there is an element of that, but the basic reason for reviewing is because we would be deemed as a danger to the public. We're, you know, the Ark Bar in its day was one of the safest places in town. We've only got a couple of major incidents. They were nothing to do with ARC, you know. So basically, we've been closed down for minor factors, but I do believe there was a political element in that.
Okay, and you're going to be opening again soon to sell alcohol, to be allowed to, you know?
At the moment, no, but we're working on that. I mean, it's no bad... Maybe it's no bad thing to have a dry house, you know, for
okay,
a little while.
For a little while, yeah. You'll certainly find more Muslims will be coming to visit you.
Well, that would be wonderful.
For a start. But anyway, Eddie, just finally remind us whereabouts exactly you are and what events you've got coming up.
Well, we have this month is a particular important month for the Palestinians. It's called the Nakba, which in Arabic is the catastrophe or disaster. It's a period from 1947 to 1949 when, you know, by and large, they were cleared out of their ancestral home, and so basically we will have ceremonies concerning that, where there'll be various speakers coming in, and you know, some survivors of that period will be telling their take. But the other thing is, dispute resolution. There's still two very vital people living in that area, and they need to kind of work together. So part of our journey is to give facilities for a dialogue, you know, both between Israeli and Palestinian people.
Crikey. Well, that's not the easiest. Since the peace talks have just broken down, maybe we'll see both sides turning up here in Bristol.
Well, sometimes the leaders get it wrong, and it's up to the people on the ground.
I'll say it's more than just sometimes. It seems to be almost all the time the leaders get it wrong on all sides.
Yeah. But leaders can be replaced. That's the important thing.
Okay, well, good luck with that.
Okay,
little project,
you.
Eddie. Lovely to speak to you again.
Yeah, nice speaking to you. Thank you. Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Your voice, your choice. And I'm joined now by Jason Yannakopoulos for our news review. But before that, we're taking a special look this week, Jason, aren't we, at Wikipedia.
Indeed.
Now, the idea of Wikipedia being essentially to have a editable encyclopedia. That means what we're doing is... every entry in that encyclopedia, if anybody that's reading it has got something to add to that entry, they can just click edit and actually add to. The only trouble is sometimes people take away from those pages, don't they? I know you've got a news story all about that this week.
Yeah, indeed. This news story, I think we covered a bit last week, was about the government incorrectly editing Wikipedia articles
incorrectly.
Well, I mean, it's... it's what's called conflict of interest editing, where they've gone in and either edited something in favour of the government or indeed just gone on to be absolutely brutal to people who may be perceived to be anti-government.
Abusive. Now, I know this was in the news recently to do with the Hillsborough entry about the Hillsborough disaster on Wikipedia.
Yeah,
and people who had been abusing Wikipedia, it was traced to their IP addresses in the British government. I mean, one also wonders, say, for example, you've got a government department like the Home Office, the Wikipedia entry on that. Now, the government's going to take a great deal of interest, I would imagine, in making that page say what they want it to say. And criticism of the Home Office, they're going to want to keep it off.
Yes, and in fact, this is since then, I've found an awful lot of this. Both British and US government have been guilty of this, as have the Canadian and Israeli governments.
No, it's not just governments, is it? It's also big corporations.
It is big corporations. In fact, I've got a whole list here of companies and...
So they've spent their profits, rather than ploughing them back into the business or giving them to shareholders or doing what else, they've spent that on altering their Wikipedia page to make it look better.
Yeah, in fact, another one that's traced back to Whitehall, and this one's really horrible, talked of an area of South Africa that's there, the edit they made read that black people were sort of like uncouth and just believed in myths and legends and stories and all that, and that
okay, so racist stuff as well.
Racist stuff, and this one was traced back to a Whitehall computer. This one was traced back to a government computer.
Okay, so corporations and government are abusing this. One of the people that they use to abuse it are companies like Bell Pottinger. Now, this is an interesting world, the world of people like Bell Pottinger. Tim Bell, who runs it, he's the chief spin doctor, unofficial spin doctor. It's a private company for the Conservative Party and for other big businesses. But there is this whole world of PR and strategic communications. There's another company, fascinating company, called Strategic Communication Labs, which virtually nobody's heard of, who do massive amounts of this kind of thing, spending vast amounts of money on making people's images look good and doing things like if a negative story is about to come out in the news, they will be issuing denials to try and stop that the listeners and viewers ever seeing that story. So what companies are abusing Wikipedia, Jason? Well, I'm very interested to hear, because these are the sorts of companies that I don't want to do business with.
Well, certainly. Well, at the top of my list here are the FBI and the CIA, who have done wiki edits on things such as the Iraq War and Guantanamo Bay.
Which they are responsible for, possibly with war crimes too.
Another one traced back to them was Edward Snowden's page. His status changed from dissident to traitor
by the very people who he was criticising. Very interesting. So, okay, so FBI, which is basically the US version of their internal intelligence service.
And the CIA, they're external.
And the CIA, which is external. Yeah, a bit like our MI6, which is external in Britain, and MI5, which is internal.
Yeah, security. Other ones that have been caught up on this, I said I have a list here, and I'll print.
Yeah, just run through them. I'll stop interrupting.
This is the Vatican, the Anglican Church, the US Democratic Party, the US Republican Party, the Labour Party, the Conservative Party, Canadian Government, which we already said, United Nations, US Senate, US Department of Homeland Security, the Israeli Government, ExxonMobil, Walmart, Disney, Anheuser-Busch, the Church of Scientology, the Discovery Channel, Fox News, CBS, Washington Post, National Rifle Association, News International, Al Jazeera and Sony.
Amazing list there. Most of them seem to be sort of people you one would already think are kind of bad guys, even though you have to sometimes have dealings with these people. Like, you know, having a Sky box doesn't mean to say you agree with Rupert Murdoch, but you need to have a Sky box if you're going to watch Sky. So that's an amazing list there. Also, Al Jazeera, I'm a bit surprised at, because they seem to be quite an interesting channel. I don't know what your take is on Al Jazeera and if you watch it much,
well,
Jason.
I have watched it occasionally. They are an interesting channel. I was surprised to see them on the list as much as I was surprised to see the United Nations on the list.
Because, for example, something I only recently found out was that the National Union of Journalists has now got recognition at Al Jazeera. There was a bit of a battle over several years that the Qatari owners, didn't want that, and based in Doha, didn't want that. And you know what's really interesting to me is that the Qatari royal family have been attacked in all sorts of ways by other Gulf states, for example, and also their racehorse owners have had a real hard time here in Britain. I wonder whether that's something to do with the fact that Al Jazeera is now a real force in the world and in international affairs. I mean, say, for example, with the Ukraine crisis, almost all the Western media has been pro the EU and NATO approach and the US approach. And almost all the Russian media has been pro, that is Voice of Russia and also Russia Today has been pro the Russian approach. But Al Jazeera got a bit of both. So Al Jazeera has definitely found its role in the world's media. And yet there they are editing their Wikipedia page like big bad guys, other big bad guys. But what do you use Wikipedia much yourself, Jason?
I do use Wikipedia an awful lot, actually. I mean, not for any serious academic work. For that, I've used more reliable sources.
And what about being an editor on there? Do you ever add bits?
Well, I've edited the page. Quite interestingly, I've had two warnings from Wikipedia for creating an edit on a page which Wikipedia themselves did the same edit 2 years later.
Really? What was the page? What was the content?
It was literally about my name, the name Jason, and at the time they'd said that the name Hacin, spelled J-A-C-I-N, was a female version of Jason. I pointed out that it wasn't. The male name Jason is a Greek name meaning healer. The name Hacin is a female Spanish name meaning hyacinth flower.
Okay, so you were actually correcting them, but they didn't really like it. So maybe Wikipedia should be added to the list of people who are abusing Wikipedia.
That's really interesting. Somebody who updated their own page was none other than Jimmy Whale, the actual owner and founder of Wikipedia himself.
Wow, amazing. So they're not totally squeaky clean. But anyway, it seems to be an evolving process, and let's hope that Wikipedia get their act together and try and make sure that the people's version of history and current affairs is represented correctly and fairly, and that we don't get people throwing hundreds of thousands of pounds to try and create a Wikipedia page for themselves or their company or their government that just reflects their point of view and not other people's. I mean, I'm a Wikipedia editor myself, and I had a bit of a battle last year in order to add some interesting content, I thought anyway, to the page on Freemasons and Freemasonic symbolism. That entry than I did was a fascinating, I thought, sign which showed the square and compasses and the symbol being divide and rule. So the dividers and the ruler, I pointed out, were possibly representative of this idea of divide and rule, and this was a symbolic representation because the Freemasons use this dividers and rulers symbol with a G in the middle as their one of their symbols. So I put a comment on it, showed a few examples, it got edited out, then I put it back, and we had a bit of a edit war, I think they call it, on Wikipedia, and eventually the stuff was someone somewhere decided, yeah, we should just let this remain because it was actually making quite an interesting contribution to the page on Masonic symbolism. Anyway, enough about me. What about your news review this week, Jason?
Well, we're going to start with the horrifying story of the teacher that was killed at her school in Leeds.
Pretty horrific, isn't it? Also, she was just about to retire. I mean, my question here is not the question that I'm hearing on the national media, but it's what was this young man into? What kind of things was he? Was he into violent video games? You know, it does make you wonder, because if someone is going to kill their teacher, stab them, then, you know, I would imagine that there's some sort of strange mindset behind that. So I would like to know, you know, what kind of maybe things which are only considered suitable for adults would a child like that be interested in? And I hope police are finding that sort of thing out.
I don't know. It really depends, because it might not have been something that influenced him. It might have been a mindset. It might have been the way he was treated at home, or it could be anything. It doesn't go into that. It doesn't even actually say why he killed her.
Well, we don't actually know that he did. That's worth saying, because he hasn't actually been convicted. So, you know, until that happens, we shouldn't really pass judgment. But it certainly does seem that a child did kill this teacher, and the reasons behind it it doesn't seem like there's very much of an excuse for that to happen, particularly to such a elderly, she was just about to retire, elderly lady. So anyway, what are your thoughts on this story particularly, Jason?
Well, first of all, my thoughts are that obviously whoever did it was not in their right state of mind, either due to outside influence or something they were absolutely influenced in. I think it's absolutely horrible that a teacher stabbed in front of our class. Just imagine the effect that that's going to have, just the mental scars that's going to have on the children in that class in years to come.
Now, there's also this whole thing of diminished responsibility nowadays, isn't there? So, I mean, we may get a psychiatrist coming along and say this child, whoever it is, wasn't really in their right mind, and therefore they don't really deserve to go to prison.
Well, I think something is terrible as murder, it's hard to see what else you do with them other than send them to prison. I mean,
also even to protect society.
Yeah, just to protect society. Actually, quite interestingly, there is in Tuesday's Eye, there is actually literally an article next to that pointing out that 1,000 school pupils have been caught with weapons in 3 years.
Yes, I think they have recycled that story from a few weeks ago, but yes, it's absolutely relevant today, isn't it? Just remind us of that figure again.
That's 1,000 pupils, school-age pupils, have been caught with weapons in 3 years.
Well, that's pretty damn scary, isn't it? And it shows that there's this rather nasty, weaponisation of our youth. What reasons are behind that? Well, that's a whole other story. Also, this week, the sentencing, he's been found guilty, Max Clifford, of sexual abuse now. So what's your thoughts on this one? Max Clifford, the great publicist. And, you know, interesting, too, that quite a lot of people have been accused of these sorts of offences after the Jimmy Savile scandal. But then we've also had these big accusations about Cyril Smith and others. And it seems quite a lot of the time, the only time these accusations ever come out is after the person's dead. But anyway, what are your thoughts about Max Clifford?
Well,
Jason?
Actually, the thing with Max Clifford is, as it points out, he's the first live person to be convicted under Operation Yew Tree. So it is horrific. It is just a case of somebody who has used their fame and reputation to...
The jury were deliberating for something like 3 weeks, which does suggest that maybe it was going to be very difficult to come to a verdict. And I mean, I must admit, it seems to me this is a little bit like low-hanging fruit, where the real big crimes by people like Savile have gone unpunished, and he's gone to his grave almost laughing at the rest of us. Anyway, also, what about Peter Mercer? Who's he, and why has he been in the news? What's he been up to?
This one is another Tuesday. This is a Tory MP who has resigned after admitting to accepting, well, after being caught and then later admitting to accepting cash to ask questions in Parliament. So it sees its cash
for questions. Well, I seem to remember our very own Bristol MP, Charlotte Leslie, has been pulled up for doing something, at least allegedly, along similar lines. The Bristol Port Company asking her, giving a big donation to her Bristol North West Conservative Party, and then she was asking all sorts of questions on their behalf, it seems. I mean, she would probably deny that they were on their behalf, but the question remains, there is a connection there. So cash for questions hasn't gone away. I mean, it does almost seem, doesn't it, like some of our MPs, and I wouldn't say all of them, but some of them are sort of just like guns for hire, and if someone wants to pay them money, put a donation into the party, then they'll do whatever they want.
Then again, this really, you have to ask questions of the parliamentary process that we have in this country, and it looks as if it's going to get even worse, because the people with the money can lobby and ask for questions to be asked, but the average people on the street, people like me and you, sort of charities and human rights groups, they don't have such money, they can't ask for questions to be asked, they don't have the funds for it.
How would you suggest political parties are funded then? Now, you know, obviously Bristol North West Conservative Party needs to hire its office, needs to hire somebody to answer its telephone. How should that money be funded if not just through private donations of rich people and things like the Bristol Port Company?
Obviously, straight donations are legal and should continue to be legal, but they should also be done with an honourable cause in mind. I think the question we should be asking is, well, how much do you wish to donate, and with what intention are you donating?
Yeah, but I mean, you know, someone might just say, oh, I'm just doing it because I want to. But actually, they've just done a little deal with the MP saying, you know, that they will ask some questions in Parliament for them.
But any deal done and any transaction, any meeting of that sort should be, they should have to transcript it, you know. They should have to have some form of a formal record of what's been said and what's been agreed.
So do you think we should be secretly recording everything our MPs ever say, including in the...
Well, no, but there should be a basic register of interests. You know, if you're going to ask a question, who's the beneficiaries of the question you're asking?
Good question, yeah. Okay, the Lib Dems then.
Yes, this is a story that the Liberal Democrats have hit an absolute record low. They've hit...
Well, there's a surprise.
Bottom. They are down to single figures in percentage, down to 9% of people saying they vote for them. So that is, it's their lowest rate.
Why is that, do you think? I mean, I know you're slightly biased, being recently a student, and the Lib Dems featured quite heavily in student betrayal before the last general election. But why do you think the Lib Dems are in this position now? Is it just bad leadership, policies, what?
Well, I think it is... It's a series of failed gambles, such as the broadcast debates on Europe.
Ah, this is the one with Farage.
Well, it was a really bad thing because people didn't trust Nick Clegg anyway, and he's gone into a debate with the media darling. And well, I think actual policy wise, they're pretty neck and neck. But of course, it's not going to be portrayed that way.
Why is it? I mean, the thing is, the Liberal Party, everyone is sort of, in a way, a little bit liberal. They're slightly, you know, liberal-minded, if you can say that, which means, you know, we believe that we should be tolerant of other people. I think most people think that. So how come the Lib Dems have hit this all-time low? What is it about their philosophy that you would change if you were in charge of the party? If you were, well, if you were Nick Clegg?
Well, I think that's very difficult to say without actually having that sort of position. Obviously, I can't see everything that he sees. I think the reason of their
If you could have a word with in his ear, what would you be saying to him?
Just remember what you promised. You know, remember what got you into this in the first place. You know, remember what got you here.
Which was?
Which was the policy they made and the people who voted for them that believed in the promises the Liberal Democrats made and believed in their mission and their statement at the time. And if I was talking to Nick Clegg, I'd say exactly that. You know, this is what got you here. Remember that.
They've gone along with a lot of this division in society between the rich and the poor, haven't they? This is the thing. And that's one of the things in the election that they were completely saying the opposite, as well as all the stuff about ending tuition fees, which, of course, they did the total opposite.
It is interesting. Actually, in Maidenhead, I was talking to one of the activists, one of the Liberal Democrats activists from my local area, and I said, what are your hopes for next election? He was saying that they hope they could form a coalition government, either Conservatives again or Labour. And I did ask him, I said, do you really think you're going to have enough seats for that?
And what did he say?
He probably stopped the conversation and walked on.
Oh dear, right, oh dear. Okay, that's one way of saying no, isn't it? Okay, anyway, I've got a little treat for you now. I say it's a treat. I mean, I don't know if you would consider it such, Jason. We'll see afterwards. But I know you're interested in the Rosicrucians, aren't you? They're an organisation that also pique my interest. Now, what do you know about them as an organisation?
Well, there's lots of different theories as to what the Rosicrucians are and what the Rosicrucians do. Certainly Wikipedia page didn't provide me much. They're an interesting bunch. They are closely tied to the Freemasons, though.
Okay, well, anyway, let's have a listen now to William Cooper. He died back in 2001, November, I think, just after the 9/11 attacks, after having predicted those attacks in July 2001 on his radio show in the United States. William Cooper actually said in July, I think there will be a big attack on America which will be blamed on Osama bin Laden. Anyway, here's Bill Cooper now talking about, amongst other things, the Rosicrucians, and we'll have a chat with Jason afterwards to see what he makes of it.
May it not be long until the Holy Pyramid shall be completed, and may it be completed without the shedding of blood. Lovingly given, R. Swinburne Clymer, Beverly Hall, Quakertown, Pennsylvania, July 6th, 1916. And now you know the final truth, ladies and gentlemen. Now you know the purpose of the free trade agreements. Now you know the purpose of GATT and NAFTA. Now you know where we're headed. Now you know that the middle class in this country is doomed. Now you know that the New World Order is being brought about by the intelligence community and the secret societies whose headquarters are in the United States of America, just 13 blocks from the White House. Now you know, in the incredible admissions in their own writing in this book published by the Ancient Order of the Rose and Cross, now you know that the Illuminati is real, that Freemasonry is a part of the Illuminati, that the Rose and Cross is a part of the Illuminati, that they are also called the Order, the Brotherhood, that they also consist of the Knights Templars, they also consist of the Knights of Malta, and all of the other secret societies whose organizational structure is in the shape of a pyramid, with a few at the top who really know what the great work and the great plan is, and a whole bunch of slathering idiots thirsting after the secrets on the bottom, who will never, ever know anything. Are the cockroaches scattering? If this broadcast doesn't do it, nothing will. If this doesn't wake you up, ladies and gentlemen, nothing will. If you don't understand now the 18 hours of the series that I've aired on the Mystery Schools, you will never understand it now or in the future. If you don't know where we're headed now, then you never will. If you are not concerned now, then you have already placed the chains upon your ankles and you have already watched freedom fly.
That was the voice of the late William Cooper there on his radio show he used to do in the United States, which was on FM in his little town in Arizona, I think it was, and Eager, Arizona, and then on shortwave as well. He used to get callers from all over the US, sometimes other parts of the world, but mainly from the US, William Cooper. But he's talking there, Jason, about this the Rosen Cross as well, saying it's a secret society. He's talking about the pyramid, a pyramid structure where the very tops of all these organizations, governments and religions and things like that are controlled by this group, and they are in charge of making appointments into them. That series is part of something called the Mystery Schools, which are a series of lectures, radio talks, that Bill Cooper did back in those days. But you know what made me surprised when I first heard that earlier this week, which was he's talking about trade agreements. We've just got another big trade agreement which is being floated at the moment that George Monbiot has done a really good article in The Guardian about, which is called the TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. And this is a trade agreement. I mean, he was talking about NAFTA, I think, there, which was something from the early 2000s or 1990s.
North American Free Trade Agreement.
Yeah. And but this one is bigger because it's about TTIP is going to be Europe and the US, a trade agreement between the two, the EU and the US. And the idea being that if any law is passed in the United States or in Europe, which goes against one of the big corporations' profits, in other words, if it makes it more difficult for them to make money, then they can then sue that government. So, for example, the British government brings in something saying, for example, that you know, you cannot do this genetic engineering new thing. You can't allow those crops to go out into the countryside because they might contaminate something. Then what happens is the British government is then sued by the genetics company, Novartis or whoever it is, and they will win, and Britain will then have to unmake that law. So what it does is it puts the big corporations in control of the whole of the EU and the whole of the United States. Now, I don't think William Cooper predicted that, but he was certainly talking about similar stuff back in those days. Anyway, what did you make of what you just heard?
Well, that is stunning itself. What the Transatlantic Trade Agreement.
TTIP, Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership.
Well, that's scary, isn't it?
Also, his idea about the Rosicrucians there, he's saying the Rose and Cross, that's, I suppose, Rosicrucians is the Order of the Rose and Cross. He's also talking about it's known as other things, known as the Order, the Templars, the Knights of Malta. Now, the Knights of Malta, again, another one of these organisations, which do seem to be almost like a kind of secret society of some sort.
Well, they are, exceptionally, and they've been reproduced time and time again in various groups, including the one he mentioned there, which is the Ancient and Mystic Order of the Rosen Cross, who are actually quite prevalent in California, rather strangely.
Okay, well, anyway, I also went to do some filming in London at Duke Street St. James many years ago, well, 10 years ago or so, with NTV, the Russian channel, and I had to actually get someone to translate it in Russian to see if they'd actually said what I'd said, and they did, yeah, translate me properly. And this was in Duke Street St. James, and while we were filming there, these two guys turned up with some plates of sandwiches and things to take into this place, the Supreme Council, it says, ring once on the door. And I said, what is this place? And they said, oh, this is the headquarters of the Rose, of our organisation. They didn't want to tell me straight away, but I said, what is your organisation? Oh, the Rose Cross. And apparently it was the same address as Tony Blair's Masonic Lodge in the same exact place. Anyway, Jason.
Oh, my gosh.
So a bit more information about the Rosicrucians. Wow. And I think what we need is a panorama documentary all about them. Anyway. Okay, Jason, we'll see you next week. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Tony. Goodbye.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
One thing must stop if our government is to regain our respect and that of the rest of the world, and that is state-sanctioned torture. By keeping torture secret, the US and British governments think they can get away with it. But even with the recent revelations about extraordinary rendition, they've proved why government culprits haven't yet been jailed. They can get away with it. Whistleblowers can cause massive problems for these criminals, and a great example from the 1980s is the former CIA officer John Stockwell. He's in fact the highest ranking CIA officer ever to blow the whistle. And here he is speaking in on Alternative Views news magazine back at the time.
A lot of people have been involved with the CIA over the years. Alternative Views news magazine.
We have with us tonight John Stockwell, the former CIA case officer, who's back for an encore performance. We're going tonight to discuss the On Company Business, the documentary film that has been made recently about the CIA.
And it shows the cause and effect. For instance, it will take a look at CIA torture schools held in the United States.
The police program began on a large scale under Dwight Eisenhower. He felt there was a need to train the police to help with the fighting of communism after the Second World War. He recruited for the purpose a man named Byron Engel. Byron Engel was, by the time he came into this program, a member of the CIA.
So the only way they get their information is through torture.
Whenever one could get the information about a specific high-ranking official in torture, not one of these men off the street, but a man who had based his career on his ability to extract information from political prisoners, in the cases that I investigated, I found that they had been trained at a United States base.
Like torture, electric shocks, and beatings, and telephones, and finally, it's a few hours like that.
Many of the people I spoke with, exiles, political exiles in Europe, had been tortured with U.S. Army field telephones. They were simple, they were easy to operate, and we had sent them in large numbers as part of our military assistance plan. You hook up wires to the telephone, and you put one wire perhaps on a man's penis. When women are tortured, oftentimes the higher ranking officials will find an excuse to come by and watch the torture.
I decided that I would confirm everything they wanted. It was in such a condition, they certainly wouldn't settle for less. And I didn't want to go through any more torture. I was ideologically, I was weak enough to say, well, if they know, why not?
What we brought to it, what we as the United States, through our efficient system brought, was the sense that you used only the amount of torture appropriate to get information. And the reason torture persists is that although the cant among the police officers is that torture is not an effective way to get information, it of course is.
And torture is a necessity of the system, not because some minds, sick minds, think of it.
And then they would show, they had, for instance, Agee talking about how they would attempt to subvert the democratic process of a particular country.
At any one time, down in Latin, in Ecuador, we had on our payroll, or in an intimate working relationship with our station, one vice president, a president of the Chamber of Deputies, a president of the Senate, a vice president of the Senate, a number of senators, a number of deputies, the Secretary General of the Democratic Socialist Party. We even created a party down there, which we called the Popular Revolutionary Liberal Party, which would appeal to a lot of different people. We had extensive propaganda operations during this period also.
They love to brag about inside the agency, about the situations the CIA helped create that were so favorable to the United States. Now, what they talk about, the common denominator, is strong men they were able to put in power in key situations and governments they were able to reverse. One of these was the Shah, who was ousted in a coup, and the CIA had a counter coup and brought him back. And the CIA used to love to brag about this.
Former CIA officer John Stockwell there, relating his experience of working within the US intelligence services. Sounds like they picked up pretty much where the Nazis left off, doesn't it? And of course, there was Operation Paperclip, where they smuggled Nazis into the United States, as well as Alan Dulles, who was involved in laundering Nazi money, who was also very much involved with the US government and the CIA. More from John in future weeks. That's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly podcast and is on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Thursday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download this podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. You can hear this show and many others on Radio 4 All, that's radio4.org, and from bcfmradio.com/dialect. Thanks to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or online at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Until the same time next week, goodbye for now.
You're pushing up the daisies, pushing up the daisies, pushing up the daisies, pushing up the daisies.